Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. You can subscribe to us on Google Play, iTunes, Stitcher, and a lot of other sites that that I will figure out at some point if you like the podcast. You know, we're joined here in our very lush podcast studio here in Washington, D.C. with Josh Kroshauer, who is the politics editor of the National Journal. You have your own podcast, and you and your newsletter is?
It's called The Column, which comes out twice a week at National Journal. It's called Against the Grain.
And you are Hotline Josh.
Yeah, there's a long...
At Hotline Josh.
Right. I tweet political analysis, you know, my hot takes on anything and everything in the news. But I was executive editor of The Hotline and worked for Chuck Todd back in the day as an expert on House races. So my bread and butter was sort of focusing on those congressional campaigns, looking at politics from the ground level up and appreciating politics as much from the voter perspective as from the, consultant perspective. So I spent over a decade just obsessed with politics and
the 100-day place,
and we're 2020 is already around the corner.
But remember there used to be a time between the election cycles where you could catch your breath. I invited you in because I wanted to talk about this piece: Democrats are boosting Trump's reelection prospect by lurching to the left. I want to talk about that. I want to ask you about, I see Cory Booker is saying that the planet cannot sustain people eating meat and cheese. As somebody from Wisconsin, that's going to play well. But
he's a vegetarian, so I mean, you can't trust him.
Is he a vegetarian or is he a vegan?
Well, I mean, aren't they both?
I think he was a vegetarian. Now he's become a vegan, so he's moving
to the left.
To the left.
Is he also a cat person? Because that would be like the trifecta. is he a cat person? Single cat person?
I think that would. I mean, I would love it if Trump had a dog, as a dog guy, but not that I'm going to say that one party is the party of dogs and one's the cats. That would be unfair, but getting a pet would always be good for any elected official.
Well, you know what they say, if you want a friend in Washington, go get a dog. President Trump probably could use one now.
Of course, everybody was thinking that. That was among the weird moments of the president's speech in El Paso, where he's explaining why he's not going to get a dog. He actually would, I think, like a dog because he would like the loyalty. He would like the... just the fact that here's one person who's not going to leak on him, who's not going to break on him, who's not going to violate the NDA.
Well, he could leak on him, like on his pant.
Well, that's true. That was probably the wrong word. Okay, so Josh, you do a podcast, right?
We have a once a week podcast. Okay. We get folks in the campaign world to come on, talk about the latest campaign and political news.
Okay, well, I'm just trying to imagine. So it's your podcast, right?
It is ours at National Journal.
So what would it take for you? So, Josh, you do a podcast. You host the podcast, like I host this podcast. So I'm trying to imagine the moment at which you reach up to the headphones and you go, I'm not doing this bullshit, and throw it on the ground. I guess, look, I don't want to break bad on him. He's obviously having a difficult time. But Steve Schmidt, who, a well-known Republican consultant, ran the McCain campaign. Everybody knows this, right? If you listen to this podcast, you know all this stuff. Never Trump guy, consulting with Howard Schultz, does his podcast. Words matter, and they're asking him to talk about the campaign, and they get into some issues, and he basically walks out of his own podcast and quits. And
it's his own podcasting company too. So he owns the podcast. He is, I believe, threatened to buy the rights to, which have already been released by the company, by the hosts. But it speaks to this challenge, I think, in maybe the anti-Trump political world, which, Schmidt was one of the most vocal and energetic anti-Trump critics, but there are a lot of concerns on the Democratic side, especially that by working for Howard Schultz, Mr. Starbucks, he could tip the election to President Trump. He could take a lot of votes away from the Democratic nominee, and that's created a lot of angst, a lot of intra-party anger, if you will, and got to the point where he just stormed off his own podcast.
Well, okay, this is the part that if you are an anti-Trump conservative, you are used to being trolled, you're used to being insulted, you're used to being called a cuck, low testosterone, whatever. I would have just thought that he would have been more battle-tested. And it was at the moment where they're asking him to, talk about the 70% tax rate for billionaires or something like that.
And this is with his friends. This isn't like a frenemies adversarial podcast between, you know, two people who it's a three-person podcast.
Ex-friends.
Yeah, or ex. Yeah, well, maybe now. But
well, it would be like you, Jim Swift, asking me. So you know, explain why a billionaire tax is not a good thing, and me going, I'm not doing this because you're asking me what. I mean,
well, you know, it reminds me that there's a real criticism that there are a lot of people who were in the Republican Party but didn't care a whole lot for conservative ideas. You know, I was surprised that Schmidt couldn't easily defend why a 70% marginal tax rate isn't a good sort of centrist or conservative-minded policy.
That was exactly my reaction, was that if you do this for a living, that is an easy question. It's not like somebody has picked up your phone and said, is this your dick pics?
It wasn't personal. No. I mean, maybe it's personal insofar as it is now kind of his job with Schultz. But it's a policy question. It's easiest thing to do in the world.
But it is. I mean, this is a stressful period. And, you know, I do have a sense that the Trump era is making a lot of people lose their minds. And I don't mean that in a snarky. I mean, it's just the stress that people just hit the red line.
No, that definitely is the case. I think we all know examples of that. What's interesting is Bill Burton, the Democratic operative who's working on Howard Schultz's potential campaign, has also gotten the knives out for him. And I've talked to a number of people who worked with him at the White House, people who, you know, worked with him along Democratic campaigns, who have said off the record just the nastiest things about someone who at one time was a close friend of theirs. So politics is a dirty business. It can really, you know, break friendships. We saw this with the Trump, you know, the Republican Party in the wake of Trump's nomination. But the notion that Howard Schultz is creating this disruption, not just within the two-party system, but among a lot of top analysts, operatives, it just shows how turbulent, how chaotic this 2020 election is going to be.
Well, that's what I wanted to talk to you about, because you had a piece, and which obviously I agreed with because I wrote something that quoted your piece, that to a certain extent, Howard Schultz is being handed a rationale in a constituency by the Democrats. The Democrats are indignant and in fuego about it, but it is their lurch to the left that is creating this space that if you go into 2020 with Donald Trump versus a Democrat who's embracing the Green New Deal and massive tax increases and disruption, then you basically have given up on the center right, or the center right, center left, and so there suddenly becomes a space for Howard Schultz.
Well, absolutely. And for years, for elections past, we always used to dismiss, and rightly so, the impact that an independent Michael Bloomberg-like candidate would make. And the reason we dismissed it is because there was always at least one, and usually two, establishment candidates running for president. Even in 2016, Hillary Clinton would have filled that Michael Bloomberg space. If you like Hillary Clinton, you probably like Michael Bloomberg. You go to 92 when you had Ross Perot running. Ross Perot was the populist third-party candidate, and you had the two main nominees in H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton running to the middle. So there's never in modern American history been an opening in that sort of center-left, center-right space. There's usually at least one, usually two parties representing that middle ground. And what we may see, and what we're, I think, likely to see in 2020 is that you'll have Trump, who continues to have a lot of rank-and-file Republicans disillusioned, maybe not, you know, the majority of the party, but 20-30% of the Republican Party voters. And Democrats could well nominate someone well to the left who ends up embracing positions like the Green New Deal, top-down environmental regulations, single-payer health insurance, that would alienate these moderate suburban voters that have been going in the Democratic column in the last couple of years.
So you quoted in the article, you quoted a liberal Democratic operative who was quite alarmed at what was going on in the Democratic Party. And so there are folks in the Democratic Party who are waving the red flag that, you know, that following, you know, AOC off the cliff may not be the best strategy.
This is someone who came to me and really wanted to throw the panic flag. Someone who was talking to Elizabeth Warren's campaign. This is not someone who is in that mushy middle in the Democratic Party, who is freaking out that the party has an excellent chance to win this election, and yet they're doing everything they can to move far to the left and jeopardize their ability to beat President Trump. And you heard President Trump's State of the Union decrying socialism and only getting lukewarm applause from the Speaker, Pelosi, and people on the Democratic side just sitting on their hands. That would normally be a bipartisan issue. So socialism wouldn't receive a whole lot of purchase in the Democratic Party. And you saw sort of a preview of what Trump's campaign message in 2020 is going to be like in El Paso this week, where he just focused on the environmental policy, single-payer health insurance, the abortion proposals in Virginia and New York. This is an effective playbook. And if you remember, Charlie, you know, Trump's approval rating the day of the 2016 election was 38%. Only 38% of people thought he was qualified to be president. He won 46% of the vote and won the election. All Trump needs is a Democrat who ends up going so far to the left that they alienate that middle of the country, and he can get that 8%. To win another election.
Okay, I mean you've run down the big. I mean, if I'm sitting in the Trump White House, which of course I never will be, that will never happen. You know, it does seem like I'm being given, you know, all of my talking points. You know, single payer health care, $31 trillion tax increase, this Green New Deal, which essentially involves, you know, upending the entire U.S. economy. I mean, I think the climate change is a real serious issue. You know, it ought to be addressed. But now we're having discussions about eliminating cow farts and, you know, possibly ending air travel. So it's like they've come up with a easily lampooned target, and yet you have one Democratic presidential nominee after another endorsing all this. So what is the dynamic right now in the Democratic Party that is leading them to take these positions that really are going to come back and haunt them in the general election?
Well, first of all, for one test of how unpopular that Green New Deal could be, all you have to do is look at the Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez's own office, who put out this FAQ. Yeah. They say it was a draft. It wasn't ready for prime time, but they put it out. They leaked it to NPR, National Public Radio. And then after getting this huge backlash from everyone, they pretended that it was a mistake. They weren't supposed – that's how worried they are about the politics of what was released. And that's generally –
and how unserious the proposal was and how ill thought out it was.
And it ticked off a whole lot of stakeholders in the 2020 presidential campaign who sort of signed off on the vague generalities of a Green New Deal. But when the details came out – it just horrified even some of the leading presidential candidates.
I think there's a lot Democrats can learn from AOC in optics and in politics, but I'm not sure that on policy you should just be co-signing these things and co-sponsoring these things from someone who's no legislative or legal experience whatsoever.
Well, and the good news for them, of course, is it's happening in February of this year as opposed to February of next year. But still, you know, when I saw the you know, frequently asked questions, the notorious phrase about, you know, creating, you know, guaranteed income for people who are unable or unwilling to work. Unwilling to work. You would think, look, I'm used to Republicans, you know, ignoring my advice. But if I was advising the Democrat, I would say that, you know, stick with the dignity of work theme, that if you work hard, you know, and play by the rules, that you ought to be rewarded. Going out and saying we need to take care of people who are unwilling to work strikes me as a profoundly, you know, suboptimal.
No, it's great for millennials. I mean, that's how you reach out to millennials.
Do you?
I don't even think. I mean, look, the political challenge. First of all, this document combines some non-environmental areas, like you talked about, sort of a basic income. What you were just referencing. Yeah. I mean, that's not necessarily related to the climate change portion.
But they threw it all in.
They want to get everyone on the Progressive Coalition on board. Look, this is a real challenge. I've written this before, but like cap and trade, a market-based legislation that would have put penalties for emitting carbon, that was put for a vote in the House in 2009, 2010. And it failed. And the Democrats who cast a supportive vote in the House during that time period overwhelmingly had difficult re-elections and had to defend that vote. And that was just eight, nine years ago. It wasn't, you know, ancient history. And you've seen what's going on in France when you even sort of mild environmental regulations that affect people's day-to-day conduct in life. When that state gets involved in people's...
That's a perfect analogy.
I mean, it is politically toxic.
But this strikes me as not being about legislation at all. It's about sort of aspirational. And in a lot of ways, this seems to me to be the progressive parallel to the wall, which is the details, the facts don't really matter. It's our intentions, right? I mean, it just...
I think it's more damaging than even the wall, because the wall is an abstraction.
Right.
The wall, it doesn't affect most people. Unless you live on the border, it really doesn't affect your direct day-to-day life.
Yeah, it's not going to destroy my wallet, yeah.
my first rule of politics, anything you do, no matter how idealistic, no matter how well-intentioned, anything you do that's going to disrupt people's day-to-day arrangements, day-to-day life. And we're creatures of comfort. We like our politics to be, you know, working around the edges, making incremental change. Because, you know, if all of a sudden I'm finding, you know, I'm paying more in taxes, or I have to not buy a car, but that's because it doesn't meet the certain fuel standard, or anything that just affects a day-to-day living.
Change your doctor.
Yeah.
I mean, look at the health. I mean, look, Obama passed a very technocratic, you could even say it was supported by some folks on the right at one point in time. And yet the reason it had so much unpopularity at first is because it disrupted a lot of day-to-day arrangements of people who bought health care on the individual market.
You had a very provocative line at the end of your piece where I have had the same impression that what you see happening in the Democratic Party seems to mirror or echo things that happened on the Republican Party, in the Republican Party in the pre-Trump years.
So there's sort of the Newton's rule of politics. Yeah. For every action, there's a reaction, right? And in the Obama years, I've talked to Democrats who maintain that, you know, President Obama enjoyed going to the base on because it made the Republicans crazy. It made a lot of the House Republicans go to the right, and that helped him win his reelection, even though he suffered a historic rebuke in the 2010 midterms. So, you know, but that's why we haven't seen Trump move to the middle as well. There's some lessons he learned from his predecessor that base first politics can actually work, because you get your base energized. The middle doesn't know who to support, but then the other side goes so far to the other direction that you're almost creating a space that your incumbency can prevail.
You use the word nihilist, though.
It is, because I mean, ultimately, are you going to govern? Are you going to forge a majority in Congress? You know, President Obama famously said he was going to get things done with a phone call and a pen, signing executive orders. How did that work out, right? And how much legislation has Trump actually signed, other than the tax cuts, when he had Republicans controlling
Congress?
This is
what's fascinating, because you do have these massive problems that need to be solved, whether it's the national debt, whether it is climate change, whether it's immigration. And you could certainly imagine bipartisan coalitions, bipartisan compromises on all of those issues, except for the way both parties are approaching this. This is what you're referring to. Rather than aiming into the direction of passing this legislation, getting it done, the nihilists in the party are like, we're going to blow it up, we're going to burn it down, and we're going to pursue a politics that is not going to lead to that kind of compromise.
It's easy to do that, to do base first politics in the short term. In the long term, it can be disastrous, and we're seeing just ever extreme types of moods in both parties, and there is a middle that this is why Howard Schultz is looking seriously at an independent candidacy. The middle has been entirely seated by both parties, and if Democrats nominate like an Elizabeth Warren, or even a nominee like Harris or Booker, who moves far to the left, there could be a wide open center.
I see Cory Booker's coming after meat and cheese now. What is this story? It's from the Free Beacon. This planet simply cannot sustain people eating meat, that people have to be nudged toward artificial cheese, all of that. See, this is what's
breaking news. Donald Trump has won the Wisconsin electoral votes in 2020.
You know, I guess my head still goes back to the way in which all of these things can be weaponized against them. You know, it's one thing, rather than forcing Republicans now to confront the reality of climate change and fossil fuels, now it's about these guys are coming for your meat and your cheese and your sausage.
Yeah, I mean, this is exactly an example of government telling you what to think, how to eat. You know, it's one thing to say, look, I am a vegan, that's part of my life, and I embrace anyone who wants to support the whole vegan coalition. It's another thing to say, look, I think we're ruining the planet because we have cows, and we need to kill all the cows, eliminate meat, and affect people's way of eating and living life.
To the first crash hour rule of politics about how it affects people's lives, I mean, Michelle Obama learned this the hard way when she started messing with school lunches and all this stuff. I mean, is President Booker going to have tofu burgers for the national champions at the White House?
I can just see this being fed back. Okay, so the pushback, and you and I agree on this, but the pushback, of course, is that you know, on the Democrats, you know, they've tried, you know, both Republicans and Democrats have tried squishy moderates in the past. And maybe the formula is you go for, you know, pure, authentic, progressive, run a base election, you know, run an election that will turn out your folks in big number and essentially screw the middle.
So one of the challenges for Democrats is that there are fewer liberals than conservatives. So there's a simple math problem on the left that you don't have quite as much of on the right. I mean, on the right, you can get 36% of the conservatives and then hope to win just enough of the moderates to get a majority. For Democrats, you have a growing number of liberals and certainly a growing number of people, almost a majority in the party, that identify on the left. But when you look at the overall electorate, that's just a quarter of the vote. So you need to make sure that the moderates, which make up about a third of the vote, aren't turned off while, you know, appealing to that quarter of the electorate. It's a bigger math problem for Democrats. They've never really – I mean, look, what was the last time a Democrat really ran hard to the left and won an election?
This is a great point. This is a really – and also if you look at the Electoral College map, you know, you're going to win – you know, the bright, you know, blue states. You're going to win all of those. The battlefields are the ones where you're going to need those more moderate voters, the suburban voters who clearly are in play in this election.
And don't forget, I mean, not to engage in a lengthy history lesson, but the Democratic majorities in the 80s, the 90s, even, you know, all the way back, were built on conservative Democrats, blue dog Democrats that, you know, people say, well, like, Virginia could elect the most progressive Democrat in a couple years because they think they're, you know, their coalition is large enough to get to 50%. But even when they had power throughout much of this century, it was on the heels of more moderate or even conservative Democrats building a coalition with liberals. Whereas now, liberals have taken over the entire party. There's still a pretty small minority, 25%, let's say. And they're making it much harder to find that majority coalition with the moderates. And you know, I wrote also in that piece, just breaking down the types of voters in the Democratic coalition. Only 19%, according to the Pew Research Center, identify as liberal Democrats, the type of, you know, progressives within the entire electorate. And about two-thirds of the Democratic electorate are in another space entirely. So you can't just play, you know, the lefty card and expect to win the presidency. You might not even be able to win the nomination with those types of positions.
Okay, so we know who the people are on the progressive lane, the, you know, Democratic Socialist lane. Who do you see going for that broader middle, play the electability card, other than, say, Joe Biden? Would you throw Amy Klobuchar in there as well?
No, I certainly would throw Senator Klobuchar, and I thought her speech in snowy, your neck of the woods, Charlie, up in Minnesota.
That was awesome.
I mean, I thought that was a very effective speech. I thought she hit all the right notes, all the issues that Democrats want to hear about without necessarily the more radical prescriptions that a lot of a lot of progressives are trying to force within the party. And she's someone who's if you look at her voting record, you look at all her, you know, ADA scores, she's well within the liberal wing of the party, but she's a pragmatist. She believes in compromise and on foreign policy, on you know, a lot of the economic issues, she doesn't kind of scare the moderate voters, and she wins Republicans and independents in Minnesota, which is the type of coalition
but she's mean. She's mean to her staff.
I've heard those stories. I think that, you know, it's a problem. But ultimately, do voters care about Washington gossip that you know? And I thought her response that, you know, she's a tough boss, but she expects a lot of things, and that's what she would do as president. I mean, I thought that was an effective line to kind of get back at.
It's only a matter of time before Trump labels her Angry Amy. You know, or something like that.
He called her a snow woman.
That was not a good Trumpian insult. I mean, Charlie throws stuff at us all the time, but you know, we don't go around to the world complaining about it.
I don't ask you to pick my clothes up off the floor though, and I don't think I've written emails at 3 a.m. or anything like that.
Well, look, she'd be running against Donald Trump, when you look at a general election matchup, a lot of the deficiencies that some of these Democrats have, and frankly, that's the thinking on the left, that you can nominate anyone and they will be able to defeat someone as unpopular as Trump. I think you're asking for a problem there.
No, I remember Republicans convincing themselves that it didn't matter who they nominated against Obama in 2020 in 2012. That was just a gimme. So is Biden going to run? And how does that shape the race then?
So I don't have any additional insight to what's already out there, but Joe Biden likes to kind of tease the fact that he wants to be president, but he often doesn't pull the trigger. And look, he's 76 years old. He's got a lot of baggage from his time in the Senate dating back to 1974. And you have someone like – I mean, I think it's easy for us to look at the polls now and be like, oh, my God, Joe Biden's at 30% and he's the front runner. I mean, I actually think Amy Klobuchar is a much more compelling moderate type of candidate that has more upside, you know, as a woman, as someone who is has been in the Senate less time and hasn't been in Washington quite as long, and someone who I think is a more appealing campaigner versus Biden, who has a lot of baggage that would be unleashed and would actually, I think, hurt a chance of someone like Klobuchar or any other moderate in the field.
Any other of these dark horses? Because it's hard for me to keep track of the 20 or 30 people who are running. You have Senator Bennett from Colorado. You have Governor Inslee.
Obama, you know, the Grammys candidate.
Well, that changes everything. I mean, if that happens. But, I mean, some of these other, you know, Sherrod Brown.
Sherrod Brown is someone
who seems very plausible to me.
I think he's someone to watch. He's ironically been on the left wing of the party on trade, on social issues.
But now he seems more moderate.
Now, there was a story, I believe, it was in Politico that says he's actually not signing on to the Green New Deal, and he's actually not signing on to Medicare for all. So what was once progressive, he's now he thinks he has enough progressive credibility, and I think rightly so. And he's trying to make sure that a lot of Midwestern voters who care about, energy, production, who care about cows, who care about being a little more mainstream, he's appealing to those voters, and he has enough liberal credibility to perhaps pull that off.
So who's the front runner right now?
I mean, I like Senator Kamala Harris.
Yeah,
I think she.
We had a piece up the other day. Liz Mayer was making that case. Yeah.
I mean, look, she can get pulled into the progressive direction, and I think she's made some mistakes early on by going on that CNN town hall and seemingly indicating she supported the abolition of private health care insurance. But when you're not a white male, right? If you're a non-white female, you have inherent advantages in a diverse Democratic coalition that in theory should prevent you from having to pander to the far left, right? I mean, you can rely on support in the African-American community. You can rely on support with college-educated suburbanites who like the notion of having having someone of Kamala Harris's background being president. And, I think she has more running space to go in that middle lane instead of having to pander to progressive groups. Now, she's kind of tried to have it both ways on the issue of Medicare for all, and she's seemingly more comfortable running a little more to the left recently. But we'll see how that campaign goes on. I think she's got a lot of potential, and she probably is the one seed in my book.
Mark McKinnon made this point on our podcast yesterday, which I thought was interesting, about how California's primary got moved up,
right,
and how that gives her an advantage. I mean, not only has she won statewide office there, she's known, she ticks a lot of the boxes in Democratic coalitions, and that's a whole hell of a delegate haul. And,
Well, that's what I wonder, you guys, since I got wonks in the room here, looking at the primary schedule, because obviously you need to get that momentum going. The people that wait to win, the third or fourth primary are the ones who, end up being Rudy Giuliani in the race. So that's the argument that I've heard, that she's going to do well in South Carolina. She's going to do well in California. You figure that maybe somebody like Klobuchar is going to do well in Iowa, in theory.
Keep in mind, the Democratic field, the Democratic rules, rather, are proportional. You don't have any states that give all the delegates to one candidate.
That's important, too. Right.
So there's a 15% threshold. Now, that's going to be the number we're going to be paying attention to throughout the nomination process. If you want to get delegates, you got to get 15% of the vote in any given state. So I think that really changes the dynamic, and it makes it a lot different than the Republican dynamic in 2016, in the fact that, California is a big state. It's early, but you also have a lot of early voting, which also, makes the, and also the fact that they count ballots all the way until a month after the election takes place. The momentum of California may not be as significant as we expect right now. I think South Carolina is going to play a huge role in this primary process, just because it's majority African American electorate. You're going to have Harris and Booker competing for that space. You're going to have Kirsten Gillibrand was down in South Carolina trying to eat fried chicken. She had a little trouble trying to figure out whether you eat with a fork or eat with your hands. But I think South Carolina will have some significance in a way that it hasn't in elections past.
Okay, so going back a little bit of history, at the beginning of the 1976 election cycle, I'm not sure that anybody sitting in a room like this a year before would have picked Jimmy Carter. Year before 1992, I'm not sure that anybody would have picked Bill Clinton. Is there anybody that is going to come out of nowhere and surprise us, or have we moved into a different era of politics? Well, obviously, we've moved into a different era of politics. But is there anybody that you might think might surprise us?
We're going to be surprised. I mean,
by anything.
And even in the Republican field that Trump pretty much dominated, there were surprises along the way. First of all, I think the biggest surprise is that we may have a real chance at having a contested convention.
Okay, and I was going to ask you that next. In Milwaukee, possibly.
In Milwaukee, potentially. I was on C-SPAN. We had the two Iowa and New Hampshire Democratic Party chairs on the show. And the Iowa Party chair, Troy Price, said, yeah, it's possible. And there's a real chance because of these rules, because you have such a big field and you don't have a winner-take-all system, that you could have like six or seven candidates trucking along the country, each getting a decent share of delegates, and having the convention where no candidate has a majority of the delegates. And one of the interesting rules – Democrats got rid of the superdelegates, right? Superdelegates are the members of Congress, the party leaders, the rank and file members of the party that generally steer the vote in a more mainstream direction. Republicans didn't have a big role for superdelegates, and that I think helped Trump win that 2016 nomination. The superdelegates don't have any role in the process this time until the convention.
Oh.
So we could – I mean I hate to like kind of – this is maybe a long shot scenario, but you could have a situation where no one has a majority of delegates. We get to maybe Milwaukee and the superdelegates decide this nomination. So you could actually have sort of the party bosses actually picking the nominee if we have a very closely contested –
Like an electoral college tie, you know, in the
Okay. Now, I used to know this stuff. So when's the last time we had a convention with multiple ballots? So you have to go back to the 50s for that?
Wasn't 76, right? The Reagan-Ford?
It was close, but I think they got it on the first ballot, didn't they?
I think it was 70.
It was 76. It would have been Reagan-Ford, but I don't think that it went to the convention, but it was...
you may be right. You may have to go back to the 50s.
At least in 80 for, you know... Weren't there multiple ballots for vice president? I mean, you're asking about president.
I'm talking about multiple ballots, and this is the kind of stuff I used to know. But for some reason, I'm thinking you have to go back into 1956 or something like that. You know, an Adlai Stevenson type thing, or maybe.
Well, and remember, until very recently, party leaders had an outsized role, and even though we're voting in the primaries, we're casting our Democratic preferences, the hidden hand of the party leaders, of the superdelegates, always was a major factor in party nominations, even when we went to a full-fledged primary and caucus system. The decline of party elites that we learned in 2016 for the Republicans and for the Democrats, it may be in, you know, supercharged mode come to 2020. So no, you could have a different candidate winning different primaries and no ability for the party leadership to really get a handle on how to guide the process.
So we cannot end this podcast without getting an answer to this. And Jim Swift is already, you know, Googling this question. Last time there was a multi ballot convention, because that's, you know, that would be dramatic. I mean, given how incredibly boring these conventions have become, yeah.
This is from Pew. The last time there was serious doubt about who a convention would nominate was in 1976, when Gerald Ford and Ronald Reagan battled for the Republican nomination in Kansas City. And the last time a leading candidate came to his or her convention with less than a majority of delegates was 1984, when Walter Mondale was a few dozen short.
Really?
Despite a last-ditch effort by Gary Hart's campaign to persuade black Mondale delegates to deprive Mondale of a first ballot victory by voting for Jesse Jackson, Mondale cruised to the nomination.
I was going to say,
about that
84 was Mondale, Hart, and right? It was just three serious candidates. I mean, we could have 10, 12 serious candidates. So just the sheer size of the field makes it more and more likely we could
And
have.
I forgot about the proportionality. You know, I thought, you know, you were kind enough not to dunk on me for being wrong about California and its importance.
Well, it's still important.
No, I think it is very important. It's just a weird system.
But if they keep lasting, you know, if there's a huge field, let's say there's 20 candidates, and this starts getting winnowed down to, you know, 15, 10, 7, and, you know, all the losers didn't really win much of anything, and we keep going and going and going, that's a pie that's divided up into a lot of slices.
But if Kamala Harris gets 30% of the vote in California, that's going to the headlines will be that she wins California, right? I mean, you know, even though she doesn't nail down all the delegates.
Well, we may not know the results and who gets the delegates till. Right. I wrote a column just decrying this voting system in California that takes a month to count votes.
What is the problem with them?
So they decided to expand access to allow as many people to vote as possible.
This sounds good.
They allow you to. You can cast your vote by mail, As late as the day of election day. So you
why not after?
You receive if you're a California Board of Elections, you receive those ballots about 2 or 3 days after the election.
Sort of like filing your taxes, as long as you do it on tax day, right?
Yeah, and it's all by mail, and they basically have this complicated system in which you kind of have to compare your signature to make sure the ballot's legal, and it's all designed to get more and more people engaged, more and more people voting because they all get their ballots mailed to them. But you know, we saw this in the midterm election. It took about a month to actually cast all the ballots and to actually know who won some of these very close House elections. So imagine that, you know, translate that into the California primary. It's an early vote. It's in, I believe, March, first week of March. You could not know who won that California primary all the way down into April when other states are actually casting pretty big ballots.
So you're bearish.
That's a very good point.
So you're bearish on California, that California will give somebody like Harris the big mo.
Well, here's my big question. New Hampshire and Iowa, traditionally, at least one of those states, has really set the front runner in place. New Hampshire and Iowa are also among the whitest Democratic electorates in a field where you have the most diverse candidates in American history. So, you know, if New Hampshire likes, like, I could see Amy Klobuchar. She's right next door to Iowa. She's already gone to Iowa before as a senator from Minnesota many, many times. Let's say she finishes second and gets the big mo out of Iowa. And she's also the kind of candidate that does well at town halls and really in those small settings in New Hampshire could really overachieve. So let's say she comes out of nowhere, does well in both those states. But I could also see her not doing so well in South Carolina. I could see her not having the money in California and some of the big states to compete. So you could have, because of the demographics of New Hampshire and Iowa, usually that helps pick a good candidate. But this year it could actually be sort of an asterisk on the system.
Yeah, and she could turn out to be Tim Pawlenty.
So, and look how that went. But at least Tim Pawlenty, if there were 20 candidates in 2012, maybe Tim Pawlenty would have had a different, if all the attention wasn't on him and was a little bit of a different dynamic. Who knows?
Minnesota has a funny history when you think about it. You know, they're sort of like almost there. Just, you know, you get Hubert Humphrey.
And Walter Mondale.
Mondale. Then, you know, you get, all of these guys. And Eugene McCarthy, who actually did play a decisive role in 1968 in his own way.
Well, and she's betting, Klobuchar and Booker, too, actually, are betting that even though Democratic voters seem to be angry right now, that the general mood of the country wants something a little more optimistic, wants to be something that's a big contrast to.
But they do not want someone who is going to nag them about eating meat and cheese. I'm just saying right now. Josh, thank you so much for coming in. Josh Kroshauer, Jim Swift from The Bulwark. And thank you for listening to The Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we'll do this all over again.